needs to step up and has to take on security guarantees should come before any agreement.
Механизмом принятия решений по использованию военной силы.
Europe has been verified as an age-slow, fragmented, constrained sideline. The threat that I'm worried the most about vis-à-vis Europe is not Russia, is the threat from within.
Zerreißt Europa, zerreißt Deutschland.
The Art of Diplomacy. The official podcast of the Munich Security Conference.
Welcome to The Art of Diplomacy, a podcast from the Munich Security Conference. My name is Florence Gaub, and I'm the host of this podcast. In my real life, I run the research division at the NATO Defense College in Rome. We think about the future, especially about bad futures, precisely so that they don't happen. But in this podcast, we will not talk about the future of war or even geopolitics. We will talk about diplomacy, diplomacy as a craft. We will speak with some of the world's most experienced diplomats, negotiators, people who spend their entire careers, even lives, managing crises, avoiding the worst, managing conflict, and trying to build agreements between people who really, really don't want to agree. The question we have is, how do diplomats actually do their job? How do they solve conflict? How do they manage pressure? How do they manage sleep deprivation? How do you become, in short, a good diplomat? This podcast grew out of the Munich Security Conference, precisely because this is one of the places where diplomacy actually happens every year, very, very intensely. So it's a good place to start. And to introduce this podcast and to talk a bit about the plans that we have with it, I'm joined today by Benedikt Franke, the CEO of the Munich Security Conference. Hi, Benedikt. Welcome.
Thanks, Florence. Great to be here.
So let's talk first about what the Munich Security Conference actually is. How did it begin? What was the idea? What was even its name? Because I know that it changed names quite a bit. In the beginning, it was called Wehrkundetagung, something that most foreigners probably won't be able to pronounce. So Benedikt, where did the MSC start and how did it become what it is today?
Today, everyone knows the Munich Security Conference as a leading diplomacy service provider. It's the world's leading platform for the debate of foreign and security policy. We started from a very humble beginning. We were founded by Ewald von Kleist, one of the few survivors of the Stauffenberg attentat on Hitler, who, after the end of the Second World War, wanted to recreate a level of trust, a network with American security officials. And hence, with the help of a young Harvard professor, you may know the name, Henry Kissinger, set up a first meeting in 1963 under the term Wehrkundetagung, which really is a symposium on defense science. From that small gathering of 43 people, over those 60-odd years, we've developed into a gathering for thousands, and with a much broader mission than just the transatlantic relationship and the network between American and German professionals. At the same time, we've never really forgotten these roots, and we try to do everything that we do with this idea of building trust and networks for diplomacy.
So I want to briefly touch on the location, which you haven't mentioned, the venue, because it's actually really part of the brand Munich Security Conference. It's a hotel in the center of Munich called Bayerischer Hof. It was also where the first democratic parliament was housed of Bavaria right at the end of World War I. Of course, at the time, you know, 43 people, that's a pretty small number. Any hotel can house that. Why did you choose this location and since when, particularly this location?
In fact, since the very first time. So the very first Wehrkundetagung took place in the Bayerischer Hof, which was called Hotel Regina at the time, in a room that has recently been recreated, the Palaishalle. It has been there all the time except for 2 years when it was moved to the Park Hilton Hotel in Munich for some security considerations. But we are in love with this venue, which... And you've been very kind not to mention it yourself, which really is totally unsuitable for what we're doing at first view. You know, you may say this hotel is too small. This hotel is too quirky. It doesn't have enough facilities. The elevators are too tight. The staircase is a drama. You could make all these points. We believe this is part of the success story of Munich. It forces people, this hotel, these narrow corridors, these tight staircases, force people to get into contact with each other, breaks up bubbles, and provides many, many opportunities for engagement and conversations that, let's say, at first sight, more suitable venue, like a trade fair or a conference hotel, wouldn't be able to provide. In fact, allow me this little advertising block. This podcast is named after a book that we wrote a couple of years ago. And in this book, there is a chapter on the importance of venues for diplomacy. And I mean, we all know how important it is to choose the right venue for a peace treaty. It should always be symbolic. But part of the idea of a venue is to create a certain emotion. And with the Bayerischer Hof in Munich, I think we have created several emotions that are inseparable of our success, namely this crampedness, the truth that we've always been there, and the fact that no one in their right minds would actually organize a conference like ours in such a hotel. It makes us special. It helps to maintain the myth.
I have a funny story about the Bayerischer Hof, because the first time I went, I can't remember if it was 2018 or 19. I think in total I've been 6 or 7 times. I can't remember now. But it was so crammed that I nearly elbowed Joe Biden in the corridor because it was so narrow. And my colleague kept saying, "Florence, Florence, there's Joe Biden behind you." But I think that's exactly what makes the place at the end of the day so suitable, because it's so narrow. You will inevitably bump into famous people and also less famous people. But that's the Bayerischer Hof, of course. It makes it so special.
You know, the amount of times that I got locked up with somebody famous in an elevator, or got stuck in the toilet because Mike Pence used the cubicle next to mine to sort of retract his speech before he went on stage, that is part of the Munich charm, and it's part of this very personal business that we're in. I keep making the point that diplomacy is a people's business, and nowhere do you see that people's aspect of diplomacy more in action than in Munich.
And actually, that's exactly the idea behind this podcast, because we already have a lot of focus on agreements and procedures and structures and what have you. But we're actually really looking at the people doing this. We want to focus on the human dimension of diplomacy. And I think what's interesting in Munich is that it's happening at two levels, you know, the ballroom, the big speeches, but actually everything you just described, the human component in the bar or even in the bathroom.
You know, I think in Munich, we have more than two levels. Yes, you have diplomacy in the main hall. That is more of a public broadcasting of diplomatic efforts. And then there is the second level, official diplomatic meetings. You know, we host the foreign ministers meeting of the G7, or we've done NATO defense ministerials at the sidelines, etc., etc. They're pretty official. They're scripted like so many other diplomatic gatherings. But then beneath those are several levels of human-to-human interaction that we quite often curate and deliberately generate. Yes, sometimes stuff happens by coincidence, by accident even, but quite often it's us creating opportunities for people to speak to people without any script, without any mission, without any hidden agenda, just in order to create networks, build up trust and faith in each other, and open potential front and back channels.
And one of those opportunities that you've created, and I feel like a fool for not going earlier, this year I went for the first time to the Munich Security Cup, which is a tournament for kicker foosball, Saturday night, famously, table football, call it whatever you want. And I, first of all, had so much fun. I played with my boss. I have to say, I'm not good at it. We didn't make it very far, and my boss is outstanding at it. But most importantly, I realized how many important people also go to this event. Can you tell us a little bit about what the idea behind this was? You know, what are the benefits of playing kicker foosball together?
Sometimes we get criticized for adding wild formats to our conference that seemingly feel out of place in a serious place for serious people. We beg to differ. We want to disagree with those that think there is no space for social formats like that. People that are coming to Munich have dozens of meetings every day, several speaking roles per day, many interviews per day. And there is very little space between these official appointments to actually have real human-to-human interactions. And we thought long and hard, what could we do? And we quickly figured out that it needs to be something highly interactive, where you get to speak to many different people in a short span of time, and something that breaks up the mood, the somber mood, into something that is more akin to a party. And we came up with Fußball, Kicker. We've had, I think, roughly 80 teams this year. You know, the German army playing the U.S. Air Force, the German intelligence service playing, you know, the Nobel Peace laureates. It's wild, wild mixtures of personalities joining us. The U.S. Senate sent a team this year, as did the German Bundestag. We've had some very prominent participants in the last year getting very far. John Kerry was surprisingly good at this. But the point is, yes, this is a fun thing to do, but it also leads to new networks. It leads to shared experiences, to shared stories, to, you know, new engagement opportunities. I think this is probably one of the cleverest things we've ever come up with.
I think the importance of human interaction for diplomacy, that is, of course, something you emphasize, but we've also come across this in our conversations for this podcast. And you know who's a really good example of that is Rafael Grossi. He is the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But more importantly, he's a super skilled, experienced diplomat. And when I spoke to him on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference, I realized exactly that, that being human and how you hone being human is important to the craft of diplomacy. He taught me that.
It's no coincidence that you've begun with Rafael Grossi, because he really is somebody that adds a human touch to diplomacy. It's no secret that he's one of the front runners in the race for the next Secretary General of the United Nations. But what many people, I don't think, know is how humble, how stress resistant, and how much he is the epitome, the shining example of a true diplomat. And by the way, he has 8 kids, so maybe some of this stress resistance comes from being the father of 8 kids.
But you know, what I found very interesting with him was that he talked a lot about how he, well, actually maintains his mental health. It's actually quite a discipline to work out, stress the importance of sleep. Even what you're eating is important. And at some point in the conversation, he touched me actually quite a bit, because he talked about the loneliness of being neutral, you know, as a diplomat, because when you're neutral, neither side will actually be really happy. And so you end up being quite lonely. I found that quite touching.
You know, there is diplomacy and there is diplomacy. Nuclear diplomacy, which is what Rafael does these days, is probably the one form of diplomacy with the most pressure, where the stakes are highest, where permanent threat looms above you like a, you know, Damocles sword. And staying sane, staying human under that kind of pressure is something that we should all admire more than we currently do.
Well, thank you, Benedict, for sharing your MSc insights and wisdom with us. And here's my conversation with Rafael Grossi. How's your day?
Very good, very good. Lots of things. A few panels I participated, and also, as is typical here, many
good meetings.
Many good meetings. Yeah. So it's good. It's really useful.
Actually, before we get right into it, do you have a trick to stay healthy during those crazy meetings? Do you drink a lot of water? Wash your hands?
During the meetings, well, lots of water. But in general, I do a lot of sports.
Ah.
This is very important for
me.
What
do you do?
I train every day.
Wow.
Almost every day, not today, but I train, I run, I have a routine. So physical training is absolutely essential to be able to cope with all the travel, you know, the stress. You know, good ideas come when you're running. As a runner, runners will know that it's a time of introspection.
Yes.
So for me, it works fantastically.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want some water, perhaps?
Ja, I'm fine.
Können wir zwei Gläser haben?
Haben Sie prickelndes Wasser?
Ah ja, I forgot you speak German.
Some
prickelndes Wasser is very nice.
Yes.
So this is ohne.
Ohne.
Hätte gerne
Gas?
Mit.
Okay, das ist. Wir schaffen das.
Nee, wir schaffen das. Ja, aber wir haben.
Ah, wenn Sie haben. es ist.
You know, I'm French German. My mom's French, my father's German.
On peut parler
en français, mais je crois qu'il préfère pas.
En espagnol, non.
Un poquito.
Un poquito.
Un poquito.
Italiano?
Sì. Vivo a Roma. Quindi...
A Roma? Sì. Sì. Io sono anche italiano, figlio di italiano.
Ah, vero?
Figlio di italiano.
Ah, dunque, questo non l'ho saputo. Da dov'è in Italia?
È dal Piemonte.
Ah, che bello.
Un piccolo paesino accanto, diciamo, Tortona.
Sì.
Quindi ho la famiglia anche... Sono argentino, ma come tanti argentini noi siamo un po' dappertutto, no?
Sì. Ah, questo...
Benissimo.
Quindi anche...
Torniamo
anche...
all'inglese, se
esatto,
vuoi.
So that explains why you also speak many languages like myself. Yeah. So, let's get into it. But I really liked what you said about the running and the keeping fit.
So important.
Because I think people underestimate the physical component of being a diplomat, of traveling, of long hours, of food, drink.
It destroys you. And if you eat everything they put in front of you and drink everything they pour in front of you, then you are really done. So you have to have a lot of self-discipline, a lot.
And so... Was there a time when you started as a diplomat where you had to learn that at first? Was there a time when you ate and drank everything they put in front of you?
Well, never really, but not that I was so conscious of that. Yeah, you know, when you come of certain age, you start to realize that you have to really take care of yourself. I always like to play, you know, football and or tennis or things, but then a serious training, it's been the last 20, 25 years, and it's been really important, and I would say that indispensable, especially, you know, these things like this marathon that like we are having today, to stay focused, to have the levels of required energy, and the travel destroys you.
Yeah.
Literally. So so you sleep very little, etc. But you have to keep the discipline to put the alarm clock at 5 a.m. or 4:30, wake up, do your thing, and then you feel so good. So for 10 or so minutes, I believe I'm crazy and why I'm doing this, how can I be so stupid that to continue doing this? But then I feel fantastic. So yeah, physical training is every bit as important.
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually my first question is, being a diplomat, did you feel that you were taught, or is that something that you learned mostly on the job to be good at your job?
A bit of both. I like the idea of being a diplomat. You know, when I was a kid, people said, you're very good, you have to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be a good lawyer because I had to have a conversation, argue back, etc. But I like diplomacy. And people said, well, you know, are you sure about this? But so, but then I saw people operate. You can have your own ideas of how to negotiate and all of that, and you can read. But it's actually seeing. You learn a lot today. I learned a lot today. And it's not a phrase. You know, you see how certain people act, how they, and by action, by agreement or opposition, sometimes you see exactly what you would never do. All right? And what you abhor in a respectful conversation, but all of that shapes you up nicely.
Can you give me an example of something that you learned today or in the past, something that you observed and watched and felt I absolutely will do that in the future or will not do that in the future myself?
Well, it's also a matter of, this time it was more self-restrained. Because, you know, I have lots of interviews, lots. I'm busy with some of the themes that are most sensitive and people care a lot about and people have very strong opinions about, like Ukraine, the war and everything, or Iran and even nuclear energy, especially in Germany.
Yeah.
It so happens sometimes where you come across people that are very aggressive, very hostile. And then you have to make an effort to keep focus, like the Americans like to say, to keep your eyes on the ball and not to miss the perspective of the message that you want to pass. And this happens all the time.
So you used words that are about feelings, right? So aggressive and hostile. How do you manage your feelings in a situation like that?
Well, it's one of the difficult parts. For someone in my job, or in any top position like this, where diplomacy is necessary, and when you have contending interlocutors, impartiality is, of course, indispensable.
Hmm.
But impartiality is a very lonely place and a very misunderstood place and a very thankless place. If you go to my X account and I talk about something that I'm doing, for example, in Ukraine, you will see below people that at the same time are saying that I'm a puppet of Zelensky or Putin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm? Or when I talk about Iran, there will be people that will say that I'm a Sikh Zionist, or the others will say that I am being played by the Ayatollahs.
Mm-hmm.
And here I'm giving you the nice version of that. But that is the toxicity of the cyberspace, as we all know. What I mean is that... It's an exercise of really constant soul search as to what you're doing, what you want to do, why you want to do it, and not jump, I'm Latin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of passion in me, even in what I do. And sometimes you feel that what is being said is terribly unfair, not true, you know. But you have to control that it's not perhaps easy. It's not perhaps it's not good in a normal life, in day to day life. Speak your heart and tell things. Silence is precious sometimes in negotiations, in conversations. There are things that are best said or not, depending on the circumstance and what you want to achieve.
Mm.
So all of that requires, well, it's a word that I used before, discipline.
So you mentioned that you run. Now we talk about discipline. It sounds like it's actually you almost sound like a monk. It's hard work what you're doing.
You know it takes a lot of effort, physical and mental effort.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say to go to that extreme, because that extreme is a connection with spirituality that I don't know if I would ever be able to have. But certainly and it's nonstop. This is the other thing, which sometimes feels like is too much, because it is, of course, any time in the night or the day, and the concept of a weekend, even the concept of a holiday. I try to take holidays because it's a hygiene measure to try to disconnect a little bit. But you know that there will always be something that will come up.
I would like to ask you for a few concrete examples. And let's go into the past. It doesn't have to be Ukraine or Iran or whatever. So can you describe a situation perhaps from earlier in your career, also before the internet, so before you had this constant, was it easier to manage the situation, or was it just in a different rhythm but essentially the same? Do you have a situation where you remember emotion and stress rising earlier in your career, and how did you handle it?
Stress is always there. Now it's like everything is very raw.
Mm-hmm.
There are no filters.
Mm-hmm.
We see things happening that contradict everything I learned about the art of diplomacy or protocol before. Mm-hmm. Not always, because some people continue to exercise that, but we are in a world where anything goes. So, in diplomacy, let alone insults and all these kinds of things that we see from very important people.
Mm-hmm. Mm?
But there will be certain golden rules. You never interfere in another country's internal politics.
Mm-hmm.
Now we see this is open. Here you see it in Europe, somebody from Germany would intervene and have opinions and go and try to interfere with elections in Italy, and somebody from these countries will come here and they will say incredible things, and they will operate together and against each other. All of these things were unthinkable in diplomacy 30 years ago or 40 years ago. There were certain red lines that people would respect. I'm not saying it was better. I'm simply saying it was different.
Mm-hmm.
It was different.
You said golden rules. So this is one of the other golden rules of diplomacy?
One, that it's timeless. It would be listen. And the art of putting yourself in the shoes of the other person.
Mm.
That doesn't mean it's perhaps to defeat that person diplomatically. But if you don't have that ability, it's some people say that they do, but they don't. You have to understand what is this person thinking, what are this person's goals out of this conversation, or, and this happens to me all the time, why is this person accepting me here? Why? It's because, you know, when I deal with the presidents of Russia and Ukraine, I have to think that I'm not there to give a lecture to anybody. They don't need that from me. They don't. So, but this is what people outside sometimes expect from me, that I go and say what they have in their hearts, only that I'm there to do something else. My objective is to, for example, avoid a nuclear accident at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, that this adds to the misery of the war. How can I get that done? Will I get this done by accusing my interlocutor of being this, 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 or that? No. But people, some people, maybe legitimately expect me to do that or to say that, or the contrary to the other, you know. And this is why I was talking about the loneliness sometimes of the position, when you try to be impartial and try to stick to your mission and try to achieve something. So listen, put yourself in the shoes of your interlocutor.
So for the power plant, is that, would you say it was mainly that, the listening that got you to where you wanted to be?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Other things as well.
For instance?
Other things as well. Study. Know your stuff. You have to know your stuff very well. If possible, more than the other person. But you don't need to show it. It's not a show-off. It's simply being very, very sure of all the aspects of the problem. So you feel very assertive and self-assured that you are in safe territory, that you're not going to be confronted with something that you ignore. Otherwise, I mean, you'll be there. You'll survive the conversation. Of course, the conversation will come to an end, but maybe in terms of results, it would have been a disaster.
So, you know, I Googled the definition of diplomat, and it's interesting because Google says it's either an official representing a country abroad or a person who can deal with others in a sensitive and tactful way. Now, ideally, we want both, right? So would you say that it's every diplomat, as in every official representing a country, is also, would you agree with this definition that sensitivity and tactfulness is an important ingredient?
And you found very kind definitions of a diplomat. There are a few others that I have come across, like it's someone that you send to a country to lie and things like this, and there are even worse ones. It refers to what we were discussing just now. I think you have to know what buttons to not to press, because it doesn't lead you anywhere.
Yeah. I have prepared a little game. Don't worry, nothing scary.
No.
I'm sure you know the game either or. Would you rather this or that?
So don't worry.
So I have prepared a few moments from history, diplomatic history, historical moments, if you had to travel back in time. And you can tell me which one you would prefer and maybe explain to me why. Would you rather negotiate the Dayton agreements or the Good Friday Agreement? So if we listen to Dayton, Bosnia-Herzegovina, 1995. Good Friday was Northern Ireland, Ireland, 1998.
Yeah. Both very important moments. Definitely Dayton.
Why?
Simply because Dayton, and with enormous respect to the Good Friday. Good Friday is more of an internal national thing, which has so many implications, even religious implications, spiritual implications, and I feel for that and for that it was. But Dayton, because of the I would say, is an international conflict with many angles, humanitarian, also East-West redefinition after the Cold War is one of the first conflicts, the first time that war comes back to Europe after so many years with an involvement from the United States. So a bit of a... at a smaller scale of what had happened in the 40s. So definitely that, and very consequential for the Balkans and for the rest of Europe as well. So and also maybe because I would feel closer to my expertise, where I think I could have made a contribution.
Your expertise, as in you feel most at home in conflict negotiations or international, or what do you mean by that?
Conflict negotiations, hard conflict negotiations.
So this next one is going to be then maybe not obvious. Would you rather negotiate the Colombia peace accords or the Iran nuclear deal 2015?
Well, that's obvious. I mean, the second is part of my life. Yeah. Now it's in my veins. Colombia, I feel a lot about that because it's my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I love Colombia profoundly, and I know them, and I've seen since the start of the what they call la violencia, the violence, in the 1940s. So it's not a new thing where the confrontations within that society started, and it had different chapters and moments and sequences, but certainly Iran is consequential for the world. It affects and influences the balance of power in the Middle East. And we all know that until, I think, we have some form of stability in the Middle East writ large, there won't be peace in this world.
Mm.
So this is, it's one aspect. Then we have the Palestine issue and Israel and many other questions. But this is one important one. And I am deep into it.
So then maybe the next one is obvious when you just said Middle East, Oslo Accords or Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, this is a difficult one.
Yeah.
This here, you put me, against the wall.
Yeah.
I want the two.
You want both, okay.
I want both. I think they have, I mean, Oslo was also Middle East and so important. And the missile crisis, I think, was the point where we were closer to a nuclear war in history, and of course touching upon East-West relations and a situation that has been ongoing in terms of, and you still see reverberations of that today.
Yeah.
With the Cuban situation, the Venezuelan crisis, the way in which these two things are connected.
Yeah. Okay, so I give you both.
Oh, yeah, give me both.
Yeah. Last question, last either or, this is going to be interesting. Brexit or 4+2, the reunification of Germany?
Two fascinating ones. I think one is from my perspective, a bit sad, because seeing like a departure, I prefer unity. To divorce.
Yeah.
And I respect the reasons for divorce, but divorce is always painful.
Yeah.
And it means that was a history or a story of love that didn't work for some reason. And, you know, it can be argued that it's better to be separated than it, you know, we can have all these internal and in our own lives things. But I think the reunification of Germany was a beautiful moment, unforgettable, I suppose, to you guys. Must have been a watershed in your lives, in your personal lives. But you have to understand that even for all of us far away, From here, it was like a reparation that seemed impossible until it happened.
So, you spoke about love, and that actually brings me to what can regular people learn from diplomats for their own private lives. Maybe not in their love relationships, but in general. Because, you know, when we say being diplomatic, it doesn't necessarily mean a diplomat.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, because it's equated to be lying, as
yes,
I was saying.
Yeah.
Being diplomatic, I'm not saying exactly what I feel.
But solving a conflict is a skill you have to have, or negotiation is something you have to have, whether you're a diplomat.
I would say from the diplomatic toolbox for personal relationships, listen. The listening.
Listening.
Mm-hmm.
And does it help to be creative in problem solving, like finding a solution?
It's a necessity. Otherwise, you can be a diplomat, but you will be just one more.
So I'm thinking specifically about Camp David, right? So Camp David, I studied political science. The way it was taught was, look at that, the genius idea of giving the Sinai back to Egypt, but demilitarized, because this way both Egypt and Israel got what they needed from the situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Harvard negotiation technique, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly you need to be creative to come up with that solution. Is there a way to be politically creative? I mean, you said listening, so I'm guessing the other side will give you keys on what's important, or do you also have any other trick on how to be...
creativity and talent you cannot learn. You can hone it, you can improve it. Tell Messi to learn to play football. No. He can train, be better. Or Mario Götze. Tell him to learn. No, they know. They have a talent. They were born with this. What you can do is train hard, learn the logic of the game, how to read the game, how to be more opportune, etc., etc. So, frankly, I believe that there are things that come with you. You can, of course, and must perfect it with the knowledge of history, knowledge of languages. It's very important. We were discussing this. How essential is that? How can that change the whole atmosphere of a conversation when you can address the other person in his or her own language? All of these things fine-tune what you brought. That I'm talking about creativity and being different, having this plus. You can have very fine diplomats, like in any or in any profession. You will have very fine journalists that do their job, prepare well, are very correct, articulate, but not all will have this plus. You know, the art of putting more intelligent questions, or to destabilize or make the person say things that they were initially not wanting to say. I mean, there's this plus. And the plus, I think, is you cannot describe, is what is so marvelous about us as human beings. We are different. This is my idea.
Is there a person, a diplomat from history, or a person that acted diplomatically from history that you admire precisely because of that?
Oh, yes, there are a few. But I will go rather back in history, because if I come very close, it could be tricky. But... I would, you know, have in mind Metternich, incredible guy. He was dealt with very difficult cards and was dealing with them extremely well.
So Vienna Congress, you would have chosen.
Oh, yes. And I live there and I go to the Hofburg and it's still, I'm moved, you know. I read A World Restored, the PhD dissertation of Dr. Kissinger. And it's, for me, it's simply fascinating. Mm-hmm. And also Talleyrand. A man for all seasons. He was negotiating for the king. He was negotiating for after the king. And they were so talented that they were able to capture the national interest at a very difficult moment and then translated it into something that could work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and achieving incredible things that had not been achieved on the battlefield, maybe. So these two I like. There are many, of course, examples of great diplomats in every country. But I like to think about this because this is the beginning of modern diplomacy, in my opinion, a diplomacy that is elaborated, the art of the negotiation. So, that's my idea, my two.
So... One of the things that I find interesting working in this field is that the work that you do often goes is behind the scenes. The general public doesn't necessarily see what all that is going on. So that's also part of the reason we're doing this podcast, is to convey the messages, you know, or to make the public understand what the things are. What would you think is underappreciated about diplomacy or the work of diplomats that is often not seen from the outside?
Well, I think there is this cliché, you know, a little bit of the idea that a diplomat is a fainéant, like we would say in French, somebody there's walking from cocktail to cocktail. And no, diplomats in general now, and now the career is very professional. And I really like when I visit countries, that makes me feel a bit old, but that they invite me to go to the diplomatic academies or the diplomatic schools, and you see the young boys and girls and the new diplomats. And I think it's great to see that they are very hardworking. This is people tend to see expatriation as something glamorous. It can be very difficult. It is very difficult, I can tell you, in terms of your personal life, your family life, very challenging for couples, very challenging for children, because even though, you know, I have 8 children. So I can tell you that they have had incredible opportunities in their lives, but also heartbreaks. And not only couple-wise, friends, you know, you have a kid that is 8 or 7 and his or her whole life is class and the friends, and all of a sudden dad comes and say, we go. How terrible that is for the heart of this little one. You know, and I felt so bad so many times about this. At the same time, they speak languages. Today, you know, my kids are all over the place. And I think by and large, with exceptions, because in 8 personalities, you have every, you know, especially 7 girls, you can imagine, you know, with different views of the world and even what I do. But I think they had great opportunities, but it's not easy. It's not easy. It's not a world of luxury. But I have enormous respect for the profession. I think we need it.
Yeah, we do. My last question is, when you think back to the beginning of your career, when you did say earlier you really wanted to be a diplomat, did it turn out to be, if you were to travel back in time and see yourself as a young man, did it turn out to be what you thought at the time?
Every
bit of it?
I would have never imagined that, you know, I started very early on in this area, actually, in nuclear affairs, non-proliferation, security. And for me, to talk about the IAEA was like, you know, wow. And, you know, this big organization, I remember my first meeting. So had somebody said, you one day you will be the director general of this organization, I would have said, what did you drink? You know, but that has, you know, been good. And, you know, in general, I'm a kind of person that is always looking, you know, ahead. What is behind is behind. So for me, the best is always ahead of me.
Yeah. Well, on that note, muchas gracias.
Gracias a ti.
For coming here, and I'm wishing you great success today and tomorrow at the conference.
Thank you very much. It was a very nice conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The conversation with Rafael Grossi was recorded before the war in Iran that started at the end of February 2026. You have been listening to The Art of Diplomacy, a podcast of the Munich Security Conference, produced by Studio Bummens. The show is hosted by Florence Gaup and Joshua Jaffa, with original music by Jakob Ilja. The Munich Security Conference production team includes Andreas Block, Marie Zeisler, Judith Sorden, Noor Saad, and Annalena Enoit. For more on this year's Munich Security Conference and for footnotes and references for this episode, please consider our show notes. Most of the conversations in this podcast were recorded at Bayerischer Hof at the Munich Security Conference in mid-February 2026. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show and leave a review. That's it for today. Thanks for listening.